Iowa, a place to grow. That was the state slogan through the 1970s and 80s. It's also the theme of this year's Iowa Week. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. All this week on Talk of Iowa, we'll be exploring Iowa as a place to grow. We'll examine our growing problems and division. As our population ages, we'll talk about Iowa as a place to grow old, and we'll find out what makes Iowa a unique place to grow up. This hour, we are going to focus on one of the things we grow best, food. We'll find out when and how Iowa became a farm state and how that shaped our culture and our economy. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week. All week long on Talk of Iowa, we'll be exploring Iowa as a place to grow. We'll examine our growing problems and division. As our population ages, we'll talk about Iowa as a place to grow old. We'll also find out what makes Iowa a unique place to grow up and what draws so many of us back home to raise a family. This hour, we're going to focus on one of the things we grow best in this state, and that is food. We'll find out when and how Iowa became a farm state and how that's shaped our culture and our economy. And we're going to dig into early history of agriculture in the state in a few minutes. But right now, we're going to start with the development of modern agriculture. Iowa is number one in corn production, number two for soybeans, number one for pork, and number one for egg production. How did we get to be where we are? With me right now is Neil Hamilton, professor of law and director of the Agricultural Law Center at Drake University. He also grew up on a family farm. Neil, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Charity. It's great to be with you.
And like I said, we're going to dig into the early history of agriculture in a little while and why the settlers came to Iowa and how that kind of agriculture developed. But Iowa really became a place where modern agricultural policy was developed. What made Iowa ideal for that?
Well, I think it certainly builds on the history, you know, the land, the weather, the people, our use of technology that's supporting social and political system that we had. And all of those things really, you know, came together to develop this incredibly productive agricultural system that we have. And so whether it's, that whole system of farms and, of course, people, you have the combination of private property, free enterprise, a work ethic, you know, people wanting to maximize their production, and then all of the tools that were available to them to in fact, do that. And, it's just this wonderful combination of resources and forces that have played out on the state that we've grown up in.
Well, and we talk a lot about the farms in Iowa and the soil in Iowa, but one of the things that really influenced the development of modern agriculture in the state was the railway, right?
Well, certainly, having the transportation system to be able to move what we produce to the markets. And I think at one time in early history, Iowa had the most extensive rail network of any state in the Union.
And we think about ourselves as being a long way from Washington, D.C. We are flyover country, which a lot of people say about us derisively. We try to own that ourselves. But we actually had a lot of pull in the federal government, Iowans did, when agriculture was becoming what it is today, right?
Well, certainly, whether it was, the post-Civil War developments with the Homestead Act and the Morrell Act, and then as kind of our modern government system came into being in the USDA, and in the early years, Iowa almost had a lock on the Secretary of Agriculture. We had Tama Jim Wilson and E.T. Meredith and Henry C. Wallace, and then, of course, his son, Henry A. Wallace. And so Iowa had certainly a seat at the table and was a powerhouse in Congress. And in many ways, you know, there were times when that was needed. You know, we've gone through a series of economic ups and downs. Of course, the ones most recently in our memory might be the 1930s and the 1980s. But government policy played a key role in helping us be resilient and survive through those periods.
Well, and in some ways, do you feel like government policy, because so many Iowans were at the table in the years when it was being developed, is tailored specifically for our state?
Well, it maybe not specifically for us, because there are certainly other states that benefit as well. But when you think about the history of the federal farm programs and the commodity-specific orientation and the development of conservation programs, and even, you know, the farm program payments and production controls that in many ways marked the history of the 30s and continue today, though they've evolved, Iowa was a large part of what Congress was dealing with.
You mentioned already our land-grant institution, Iowa State University, and of course there are land-grant institutions in other states, but the kinds of agricultural education and agricultural research going on at Iowa State University, how much did that influence the state?
Well, it was, you know, certainly a major part of it, because both the development of the technology, but also, you know, the mechanism for the transfer of that education back out, whether it was through the extension system or through people going to Iowa State to learn more about how to use these technologies. And so this, you know, certainly the role of the land grants were part of what has helped continue to drive our increased productivity.
Now, in a few minutes, I mentioned we're going to dig into a little bit older history. We'll talk about how Iowa went from being a wheat state to a corn state. But with the kind of research being done at Iowa State University, the kind of education being done, and the reach of extension, did that play a big role in homogenizing farm production around the state and in making more farms similar to each other?
Well, I think it certainly did, and you know, part of it was that, you know, the land has a fairly you know, common denominator to it. I mean, you get into southern Iowa, where I grew up, you have a little bit more grassland, but most of Iowa has that you know, capacity to be put into row crop production of corn and soybeans, and of course the other mini crops that we raised around the time of World War II. But extension certainly made it available, and not just extension, because you also had, you know, the growth of kind of the private businesses, the development of hybrid seed corn, for example, the mechanization. And so, you know, you think of a little town like I grew up in had three different implement dealers at one time, and so there was no lack of farmer access to the type of tools and technology. You know, the question was their ability to finance it or to obtain it. And I think there, you know, as a law professor, when my ag law classes, I always talk with our students about how we probably don't appreciate the role that the law played, because whether it was borrowing money or having a market or having land titles, you know, all of our institutions allowed this very smooth functioning economy and system to operate.
Well, and I know a lot of people who are not involved in agriculture don't think about agriculture as a hotbed of technological innovation, but in so many ways it is and has always been.
Yeah, and agriculture has, you know, that idea of substituting capital for labor and capital in the form of new technology or equipment. Agriculture has been both a major consumer of technology and also a driver of its development. And it is, it certainly, you know, it's provided a great deal of opportunity, but it also has helped, I think, magnify what has historically been one of our significant challenges, which is this chronic ability to if not overproduce, at least produce more than we have available markets for at any given time. And so one of the real constants in American farm policy, and you see it played out across our state, is this the search for new markets and new uses and trying to find ways to absorb what it is that we have the capacity to produce. And that certainly continues today.
Well, culturally, we seem to have this idea that more is always better.
Well, I think our organizing principle is, you know, making two blades of grass grow where one grew before the kind of the common goal. And so we've always had our foot on, I think, the accelerator of production. But you look at, you know, whether it was the need for the set-aside programs of the 1930s or our search for export markets or using food surpluses as a form of humanitarian relief with PL 480, or even in more modern days, you know, developing high-fructose corn syrup as a way to absorb corn, or even with ethanol. You know, we didn't develop ethanol because there was a shortage of gasoline. We developed ethanol because we had lots of corn and we were looking for new uses for it.
Well, let's talk about, I know we have to let you go in a few minutes. Let's talk about some of the other problems, because when we talk about being number one in corn, number two for soybeans, number one in pork, number one in egg, a lot of people are really proud of that. But that does bring with it some real issues.
Well, it does. And I guess I like to say that I'm not sure, you know, who got the trophy for us being number one, right? And where we put it on our mantle. And I realize, you know, why we look at it as being important. I think it'd be helpful if we valued things like being number one in protecting our soil, right? Or number one in water quality. Because, you know, there are certainly some challenges. You know, our soil losses and dealing with soil conservation, an issue that we've struggled with for 70 or 80 years, is probably still not where it should be. The continuing deterioration in our water quality is an issue. You know, some of the changes are structural. You know, the issue with livestock production. You know, we still certainly are number one in pigs, but in many ways we've restructured the swine industry. Much of it's produced under contract, meaning that the beneficial ownership may have changed. And, you know, there are a number of government policies that, because they're so important to us, in some ways make us a little bit potentially brittle. And I think if you think about trade agreements and how the whole just uncertainty about trade agreements, such as NAFTA, has kind of upset agriculture, the ethanol policy, the continued existence of price supports and crop insurance, which, even though we may not like to think of it, are forms of welfare, or at least forms of, you know, transfers of payment from the government or taxpayers to agriculture in exchange for something we're receiving, right? And what we're receiving back is this continued production of all of these crops.
Well, and we've seen family farms change so much over the years. We, again, like to take a lot of pride in the fact that many farms are still family-owned, but that kind of hides part of the reality, doesn't it, when we think about it that way?
Well, you've touched on another issue that's embedded in there, and it's the whole question, you know, the land remains, but the nature of the ownership of it has certainly changed. You know, a significant amount of our land owned by people who don't farm it. Of course, many of those are farm kids like you or me or others who may have inherited the land. But so, you know, over half of land in the state's farmed by others than who owns it. It's changed the nature of the relationship, made leases much more important. We've shifted to cash leases, which provide a certain amount of, you know, kind of economic vulnerability. And so there are, you know, some significant, you know, structural changes we at least have to recognize and think about what their impact are.
Well, Neil Hamilton, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Charity. And I have to go to class, but I wish I could listen to the rest of the show. But good luck today.
Thanks. Neil Hamilton, professor of law and director of the Agricultural Law Center at Drake University. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa, and all this week we'll be exploring Iowa as a place to grow. This hour, we're focusing on our agricultural economy and our agricultural culture in Iowa. Right now, we're going to take a look back at history, and historian Leo Landis is here, museum curator at the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Hello, Leo.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And I know you're in Fort Dodge today in the heart of farm country. I want to ask you, we know about the soil. We know about Iowa's incredibly fertile soil. But as settlers were moving west, what attracted farmers to Iowa?
Well, it was a lot of what Neil alluded to when he talked about the land and the weather and the people and then the intersection of technology and the fact that 70% of our state is prairie, and so some of the best farmland in the world is here. And you have people like Ephraim Fairchild of Jones County and Eliza Fairchild who settled there. And Ephraim wrote back to his family in 1857 just saying, "I like the looks of this part of the West very well. I think that I can plow and harrow out here without being knocked and jerked about with the stones as I always have been in Jersey." And so you get this group of people who encounter land like they've never seen in their entire life.
So not just the fertility of the soil, but the lack of stones, which, of course, had been an incredible challenge for farmers back east.
Right. And of course, there are glacial boulders in parts of the state and stony and rocky soil in some of the areas. But, you know, most of the state, that prairie land is just fabulous and like something they'd never seen before.
Now, of course, as settlers were moving west, the idea that people could own their own land was incredibly attractive. And we were part of a second or maybe third wave of settlement, right, as the land was taken up, was claimed further east.
Correct. And that's part of what people like Ephraim Fairchild and other settlers coming into the state. They may have been second children in a family or third children, knowing that even if it was Ohio or Indiana, that they weren't going to inherit any land from their parents and thus needed to find a place where the government policy, as Neil had alluded to, was setting affordable prices for the land in the state that you could buy with not a lot of capital and knew that you could make a good start of it. So we had these settlers coming in who it really was as much a pull factor as it was a push factor for them, knowing that I'm not going to get land in my home state. I'm going to look to this new place in the West.
Well, and I can imagine that our lack of major landforms also made Iowa attractive. Now, of course, we had this incredible tall grass prairie that has almost been entirely destroyed or removed at this point in our history. But we didn't have mountains. We didn't have a lot of lakes. We were able to develop this grid system in Iowa that made it really easy to lay out the homesteads and to put a railway through and to do all of the things that made crop transportation and production a lot easier.
Right, and that was part of the whole idea of the Enlightenment that goes back to European ideas, but Jefferson and the founders impose it in 1787 with the land ordinance that creates that idea of townships and sections of land inside a township and then quarter sections or a full section of land. So it scientifically arranges the land. It's what when you fly over our state, at least most of the time, unless there's a river disrupting it or it's a border county, that everything is square. Though, you know, just as a quick aside, we always wonder why that we don't have 100 counties, and part of that is because of the land, and it's in north-central Iowa, what is now Kossuth County. In 1851, we did have a 100th county, which was Bancroft County, but it was marshy enough up there that by 1855, the legislature said, oh, it's never going to be settled. We'll just incorporate that into Kossuth County.
No one will ever live there. It doesn't deserve to be a county.
And once drainage took place, you know, it's some of the best farmland in the state. So that's why Kossuth County is so big, though.
All right. So as farmers were settling here, now anybody who's spent much time reading their history, whether fictional or factual, will notice, I think, that corn is not the crop that a lot of people were talking about farming back then.
That's right. And so when you look at our state seal, the farmer isn't standing in front of a field of corn. The whole idea of the breadbasket that we still think of today doesn't apply to Iowa, but it did in the 1840s when we became a state in 1846. So when we design our state seal, it's a field of wheat with bundles of wheat, and it does tie into the intersection of technology that's happening too. You know, the settlers who are coming out are from smaller farms in many cases, and so you could handle processing your crop with small amounts, but then you have people like John and Sarah Kenyon in Delaware County, and John writes back home to his family in Rhode Island saying, "I have been thrashing this week." That's the process of knocking the grain off the straw for the listener. So I've been thrashing this week, harvesting. We had 115 bushels of wheat. They use thrashing machines here. It requires 8 horses and 10 men to tend them, and will thrash from 300 to 500 bushels a day. They put me in mind of a cotton hopper, but make a heap more noise. And so this is that technology of reapers for harvesting the crop at times, and then threshing machines that were powered by horses and took community collaboration that just increased that scale from what people had been used to either in the upland south of the Ohio River Valley or even New England.
Well, and the idea of trade and being able to purchase the food that you needed to live on, I mean, that also was part of the move away from wheat, wasn't it? Because, of course, wheat was something that if you were growing all of your own food, just culturally, we were pretty dependent on.
Well, it also was geographically. We didn't have the states farther west that had lesser quality soil and less rainfall. And so wheat was critical in Iowa. We were in the top 10 nationally through 1900. We were still number 10 in the nation in wheat production through 1900. It just was, as Neil had referenced, there wasn't the need for corn. So what do you do with your fields? Well, you grow oats for your livestock, for your horses to eat, but a great cash crop and the whole network of elevators that first gets established across the state is not for storing corn, but for storing wheat. So we are, you know, in 1870, we're number 2 in the nation in wheat production because we are the nation's breadbasket.
Well, and of course, as time went on, we developed some problems with growing wheat in the state. And anyone who's a reader of history and knows about Norman Borlaug will understand a lot of the challenges that wheat farmers had, which was one of the things that led us more toward corn as well. But I want to focus on culture. Because, all right, we had all of these settlers coming here for the promise of owning their own land to be able to make a living in the new world and live the American dream. But as Iowa developed into this major agricultural state, what do you think was unique about how we developed that led to some of the things that make us think about being Iowan today?
Well, I think it is a lot of that collaborative nature of work that took place on those farms from the 1840s to the 1930s in many cases, because if you were building a new home, you normally had neighbors or relatives helping you out. And if you were building a new barn, you certainly did it as a collaborative effort. And then as even when John Kenyon was talking about producing and processing his wheat crop, and it was the same with oats, those small grains, before combines were around, you took the crop to the machinery. The machinery didn't go to the crop. And so it took dozens or a dozen men or so to do the harvesting and the threshing, but then it also was a collaborative effort on the female side. So there was a lot of shared work, both domestically and on the farm, that made you have to be friendly with your neighbors. You needed that shared work to be able to survive and profit. So I think that does still shape us today as Iowans. They talk about the friendliness, or people talk about our friendliness, and not that we don't have problems, but it was part of that shared work nature as far as I'm concerned.
So you think that that's the root of Iowa nice?
I really do. It was people who had, you know, shared culture. We were still over 50% on farms through the 1950s. So, and most of us have grandparents who might have been on farms, at least if you're over 30. And so the way we were brought up was part of that whole, you know, you're respectful of people And again, that's not to say that we don't have challenges across our state in many ways, but at least the basis of our economy was a lot of shared work through the 1930s and 1940s.
Now, in past programs on Talk of Iowa, when we've explored history, we've talked about how this also became a real magnet for people who wanted to start utopian communities, or for people who wanted to start different kinds of communities, places where there was a lot of religious freedom and they felt like they could live in the way that they wanted to live. And of course, we think about the Amana colonies as one. We also attracted a lot of people who were members of the Quaker faith who felt like Iowa was a place where they could live in the way that they believed. How do you feel like that has shaped us culturally? I mean, the agricultural land was the draw, but that made a big impact on us culturally as well, right?
Well, I think the whole notion that there was the available land. I mean, we were a big state at the time we came into the Union, and so you could be isolated and have your own communities, and that's part of even the German Lutherans or the Scandinavian Lutherans or Irish Catholics and German Catholics.
The Dutch,
yes, thank you. But even, you know, African Americans were able to look at Iowa as a chance if you wanted to be agricultural. In the 1860s up in Fayette County, up around West Union, there's a handful of African American farmers who settle there, and that is, it's a Quaker community, so they're tolerant of and embrace the idea that all people are created equal. And it's like, well, we will certainly welcome and encourage people of all cultural backgrounds. And so you do. You've got this group of free African Americans who are farming up in Fayette County in the 1860s.
So, again, we do not have a perfect history, but there are certainly things that shaped us, that made us perhaps a little more egalitarian than some other places.
And I think that is the access to land, the economic competition. I mean, you want to produce more than, or maximize your production, as Neil was saying. But the resources were plentiful in those first 40 years of settlement, because Northwest Iowa settles a little bit later, and so you do. You get the opportunity to you know, at least try to realize that promise of American success.
Now, again, with Neil, I was talking about the railroad, and he also brought up technological innovations with farm implements. That's something, of course, we're still known for now. But this is also a place where a lot of that technological innovation arose.
It either arose here or we were the testing ground for it. So you have people, and there were a number of reaper producers, the harvesting machinery for oats and wheat. But the reason that International Harvester McCormick settles in Chicago is because it's got the connection with rail networks and with the Great Lakes. And so we have access to reapers. Then you have, later in the 20th century, people that are perfecting combines and even, you know, with hay production, the big round baler and some of that. But the tractor is probably the best example, where we're transitioning from what is solar-powered agriculture with horses because they eat oats, to gasoline tractors that develop out of the Waterloo Gasoline Engine Company. And then Hart Parr becomes the first major manufacturer and coins the term tractor.
Do you feel like that kind of technological innovation, has that shaped us culturally as well?
You know, I think that is part of the whole spirit of improvement that when we came into the nation, there was this whole reform movement that manifested itself in abolitionism, in women's suffrage, in temperance, prohibition, the prohibition of alcohol, but also just the way that the federal government, when they looked at Iowa farms and farms across the country in the agricultural census, the first two things they counted were acres of improved land. That was the first thing they asked, is how much land have you improved? And that was the term, and that was taking it from prairie and putting it into production as we see being an improvement. And so that whole idea of how can we improve everything about our culture, I think, was part of what shaped us as Iowans too, and that first generation of settlers and succeeding generations. It was always about making it better, doing it better, better being, you know, changing the land, making it productive to the systems that we were accustomed to.
Well, Leo Landis, thank you so much for giving us a historical look at agriculture as it developed. I want you to stay with us because we're going to move into modern agriculture again here, and I'm going to bring a couple of other people into the conversation. Chad Hart is here, Iowa State University Extension crop economist, also an associate professor of economics at Iowa State University. Hello, Chad.
How you doing, Charity?
Thank you so much for being here. I'm doing great. And we're going to bring in a livestock guy in just a couple of minutes. But Chad, I'll start with you. Again, we've talked a lot about how modern agriculture came about in the state of Iowa. We are number one for corn production in the nation. We're number two for soybean production. What do you think combined to put Iowa in that position?
Well, I think Neil and Leo hit upon a lot of this. I mean, when I look at Iowa, you're looking at, as they said, the best soils in the world. You're looking at ideal weather, typically, for corn and soybean production. You're looking at modes of transportation where we can move this crop from Iowa to either coast here in the U.S., down along the river system using the barge system. We've got the rail. Now we've got our road system as well, so transportation has developed. And so you had this ideal combination of factors, both, let's call them natural and societal, that contributed to our ability to become what we did in agriculture.
And how big a part of the economy in Iowa today is crop growth?
Well, when you're looking at crops themselves, we're probably talking about 4% of our state's GDP is tied up in direct crop production.
Which is much smaller than I would have expected.
Much smaller than I think most people expect. And when you talk livestock, you know, we'll basically double that. So overall, true production agriculture, you know, maybe 6 to 8%. Of our state's economy. Where we see a lot more growth is, as you mentioned, on the, let's call it the technology side. When you look at food-related industries, agricultural-related industries, you add those across the state, now we're talking about maybe a quarter of our state's economy is tied to agriculture in some way, shape, or form.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Chad Hart, ISU Extension crop economist, associate professor of economics at Iowa State University, Leo Landis, museum curator at the State Historical Museum of Iowa, and historian, of course. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. You are welcome to join with your questions and your thoughts. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Iowa Week. All this week on Talk of Iowa, we're exploring Iowa as a place to grow. And this hour, we're focusing on when and how Iowa became the agricultural powerhouse that it is today, and also how that has changed over the years. With me, Leo Landis, historian and museum curator at the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Chad Hart is here, ISU Extension crop economist, associate professor of economics at Iowa State University. And Chad, we were just talking a little bit about Iowa as a corn state and being number one. Leo was filling us in earlier on how we were a wheat state for a very long time. In the 1930s to 1950s, when the corn industry really took off, what are some of the elements that came together to make that as powerful as it is?
Well, I think as Leo sort of laid out, the idea is that our agriculture has evolved to sort of fit the markets that we have. And so early on, yeah, wheat was the driving factor. You needed that food crop. And as over time, you know, things evolved. We got those Western states coming in. They sort of took over wheat production. That offered us an opportunity to look for higher valued crops. And that's what corn really represents for us here, is that, you know, things changed. We looked at more development of our livestock industry, and that led to the need for more feed product. And that's where corn specifically fits its niche, especially in that 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s.
All right. And we've talked a lot about the railroad, but as time went on, it was also the interstate highway system that made corn work.
Yeah, definitely so. In fact, you know, I'll bring in actually the barge system even with that. When you're thinking about how we move product, you know, throughout the country here, Iowa's ideally situated in that we have the Missouri and Mississippi River on our borders. That makes it easy shipping down into the south. We got the rail system so we can move east and west. And then with interstate highways, that opened up all sorts of possibilities there. In fact, you know, just listening in on a promo in between segments here, they were talking about the choke point possibly on rail when you look at Chicago. And that's one of the things that the interstate highway system helped avoid, is taking out some of those choke points in our transportation grid as we move product throughout the country.
Now, a lot of things have changed when it comes to Iowa farms. We've seen a shift, especially since the 1980s, farms getting bigger and bigger and bigger. We've gotten so much better at growing corn and growing soybeans, but we also have needed more and more land to really have a successful farm operation. I mean, here's a question from Casey, and obviously it implies some frustration on Casey's part, but what about the commoditization of crops crushing small farms? We have seen a shift.
We have seen a shift, but I'm going to argue we've saw that shift since the state was first founded. When we look back, we've seen that gradual evolution, as I think it was Neil that mentioned, where we started replacing labor with capital. And as you do that, that means the push towards larger farms, looking to produce more in order to sustain that farm. And so this has not just been a recent change within agriculture, but something that has been going on since the dawn of agriculture in Iowa.
Another thing that we've seen changing, and you can ask pretty much any farmer in Iowa about this, is that we have started to see the effects of climate change on growing corn and soybeans in Iowa. How do you feel like that's affecting farmers today?
Well, at least right now, I would say, you know, when we look right now, our past 5 years have been incredibly productive in Iowa. We've had the five largest corn crops for the country, you know, in the past 5 years. We've seen four of the top soybean crops we've seen over the past 5 years. And so right now, if you will, weather conditions, climate conditions are playing very favorably to our production system.
All right. And you see that continuing to benefit? I know you're not clairvoyant, but you see that continuing to benefit corn and soybeans in the state?
I'm not clairvoyant, but yeah, I would say when we look at even what the climate scientists are saying out over the next 100 years, it looks like for at least the next, let's say for the next 50, it's looking very productive for Iowa agriculture. When we look out 100 years, we may get more concerned if weather patterns continue to shift. And that's sort of, if you will, what we've already seen. As was mentioned earlier, Northwest Iowa was the area that got settled the latest, and that was because it was the dry part of the state. As weather conditions have improved, we've watched that area of the state become some of the most productive land that we have.
Now, I've spoken to a lot of farmers over the years, and one of the biggest challenges that young farmers or new farmers in Iowa have today, especially if they're trying to get into conventional agriculture, corn and soybeans, is access to land. We've talked about how these farms have gotten bigger and bigger. As someone who has a lot of interaction with farmers, what do you see as the biggest challenges that have developed because of how modern agriculture has changed?
Well, that's the deal. I'll go back to this idea. As we've built up agriculture to be more capital intensive, that means it does take more money, if you will, to begin to be a farmer. It's harder to purchase the land. The machinery is of such a scale that it's, you know, quite expensive to purchase the machinery. And so it is a challenge to get new farmers into the system, especially if they come with no background in agriculture, meaning that, you know, they're not working within a family farm structure already where they might inherit some of the basic requirements of agriculture. You know, for a lot of our farms, we look at those century farms when we go to the state fair. Well, that gives, if you will, those children a leg up getting in agriculture because at least they might have some of the land base with which to start.
Well, and I want to read an email that we've received this hour, something a lot of people are concerned about. It says that the large increase in production is in no small measure a result of major disruptions in our nitrogen and phosphorus cycles. This has played out in ways we understand and in ways that we're just beginning to understand with water quality, soil quality, et cetera. And we are going to talk about that tomorrow. We are exploring growing problems in Iowa. So that's one of the things that we're going to focus on tomorrow. But that's also an issue for farmers, Chad.
It is an issue for farmers. I mean, I think now when you look back over the past 5 years, farmers have definitely taken water quality issues and promoted those within agriculture itself. We are one of the few states that has a nutrient reduction plan in place. And so farmers...
A voluntary nutrient reduction plan in place.
It's a voluntary plan. So that's farmers stepping up and saying, you know, we recognize that this is an issue. We recognize that we are part of that issue. And they want to be not only part of, let's call it the problem, but they also want to be part of the solution.
All right. I want to bring Lee Schultz into the conversation now, ISU Extension livestock economist, assistant professor of economics at Iowa State University. Hi, Lee.
Morning, Charity and listeners.
Thank you so much for being here today. And all right, we're talking about being number one in corn, number two for soybeans. We're number one for pork in the state of Iowa as well. Why do you think Iowa is so well suited for growing pigs?
Well, and I'll echo a lot of the comments that Chad did as far as the infrastructure available. But also, it's very much tied to the growth of crops and feedstuff for that livestock. So we have a ready supply of feed to feed the growing livestock and the ability to move that product to population centers across the U.S. and to ports that allow us to export worldwide.
When did pork begin to become such a big part of agriculture in Iowa?
You can really go back through history, and pork has been, you know, a leading livestock production when you look at nationally here in Iowa. It has grown over the last 50 years as a percent of the U.S. If you go back to the 1960s, it represented about 23% of the U.S. production. Now Iowa's upwards of 31 to 32% of that production.
Now, the way that we produce pigs is very different today from the way that we did, you know, back in the 1960s. So that has made it possible with the introduction of confined animal feeding operations. I mean, that's made it possible to produce a lot more pigs.
Well, I think when you talk about, you know, infrastructure, but also I think you need to talk about productivity. We've become that much more productive in producing pigs or livestock in general. Take for example, you know, the we can feed those to heavier weights because of genetics and our high quality feedstuffs. We have the ability to produce more pigs per breeding animal. So actually the breeding herd has declined over time, but we still have maintained or increased our market hog inventory because of those gains in productivity.
Well, of course, Chad was talking about the fact that we grew a lot of corn, so we could use that corn to feed pigs, to feed cows in Iowa. What else made Iowa favorable for pig production? I mean, we had to have the infrastructure to process this meat, right?
Well, we have the ability from packing plants to process that, but also going back to the feed situation and that complementary relationship that, you know, it does allow us, we're growing that corn here, and we can produce that pork here and then process it as well here and really capture the whole value of that pork production here in the state of Iowa.
Now, with the way that pork production has changed and we are seeing, as I mentioned, more of these confined animal feeding operations, more consolidation of more animals on smaller amount of land, how has that affected farm culture, do you think?
Well, when you look at, you know, how it has changed, you know, we have moved to, when you look at specifically pork production, more integrators and contract growers. But also, when you look at the sheer number of operations, most are still independent, family-owned operations. Now, those operations are larger now, but they also are still family owned and have that structure of years past. But also the ability to have contract production, I think's added to individual operations, ability to add a livestock sector, to, you know, spread out some of that risk across their farming operation, as well as adding an opportunity for younger producers to get into production.
Now, you grew up on a diversified crop and beef farm in Wisconsin, which, of course, has a similar farming culture to Iowa, while it can't claim that number one spot. In your experience, farming, growing up on a farm and working with farmers today, how do you think that's changed farming culture?
Well, I think there's still a lot of things that are the same, and the reasons why farmers are in production. You know, they like the rural lifestyle, the self-employment, the ability to work with crops, the ability to work with livestock. How it's maybe changed is more the challenges that the industries face. You know, for the example of competition for land, sometimes higher feed prices make it good for crop producers, but not as good for livestock producers. And so maybe the challenges have changed a little bit. Markets react to a lot more global information than they maybe did back in history. And so there are some challenges that have changed over time.
And Chad, I want to bring you back into the conversation as well. You grew up in southern Missouri, again, in a rural culture, surrounded by cow pastures. How have you seen farming culture change in your lifetime?
Well, I think it has evolved to fit, if you will, the competition within it. As was mentioned here, the idea is it's harder for younger farmers to get in now. But we're seeing more of those opportunities develop, but they're more with a business relationship with the processors, with the feed mills, with, you know, somebody else, if you will, up or down the line within agriculture. And you're also still seeing, you know, producers are still dealing with the same risk that they did in the past. It's just now that instead of addressing it necessarily with, if you will, with help from my friends, as we did back in the 1800s, now we address it with capital. How do we address it with machinery, with technology to help reduce or mitigate our risk?
Now, you mentioned earlier that if you put all the pieces of agriculture together, it's still, I mean, it's about a quarter of our state's economy. It's an incredibly important part of the economy of Iowa. With farming changing, there are fewer people living on farms, and there are a lot of people who live in cities. We are becoming more and more urban in Iowa. Do you feel like there's a growing lack of understanding between urban Iowans and rural Iowans, Chad?
Well, I think that is a challenge for us. As you know, I think it was, it may have been Leo mentioned, the idea is that, you know, when you look at the Iowa population now, if you are over 30, yeah, you probably have some sort of memory of the farm. Your parents or grandparents were there. But the younger generation of Iowans is mainly, you know, growing up in an urban area. We're not seeing that connection with farming and with agriculture that we've had in the past. And so I sort of argue it's up to agriculture to continue to work with the general populace, because it has changed. You know, 100 years ago, half the people in the U.S. were involved in production agriculture. Today, it's less than 1%. And so there isn't that innate knowledge of agriculture that there was in the past.
There's a growing agricultural push toward returning to small farms, growing horticultural crops. We've got CSAs popping up around the state. And I've talked to a lot of farmers who are conventional. I've talked to a lot of farmers who focus on organic or horticultural crops, that local food movement. I find a lot of similarities when I talk to these farmers, but I think that there's a perception of a big gulf, of a big divide, and maybe even a battle between these two kinds of agriculture. Chad, do you see that?
I don't. I see more what you've described here, is that, you know, both types of individuals want to be involved in farming. They've approached it in different ways, and they're fitting different, if you will, market niches. The idea is they both want to, you know, work the land, work with animals to develop food products and feed products for other people to utilize. It's just that they've decided to go with a little different business structure. Some have to go large, others have gone small and more direct.
And Leo, we've seen these changes in agriculture, but we've also seen an incredible impact on our state. When I drive around in Western Iowa, I mean, there are small communities that have disappeared in the last 40 years. following the farm crisis and the changes in agriculture. How do you see that influencing our culture as a state moving forward?
I think it's part of the just nature of how lives have always transformed. When a railroad or how communities always have transformed, it's just part of the shrinking of family sizes plays out in this too. But you had communities that got bypassed by the railroad and they were gone. People would move to a new community. So the demise of communities has changed in the last 50 years, I think we all could agree. But I think there'll still be that rural nature of our state regardless.
Leo Landis, thank you so much.
You are welcome. Great to be with you.
Historian Leo Landis, he's museum curator at the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Chad Hart, thank you.
Thank you.
Chad Hart, ISU Extension crop economist, associate professor of economics at Iowa State. And Lee Schultz, thank you.
Thank you.
Lee Schultz, ISU Extension livestock economist, also an assistant professor of economics at Iowa State University. Iowa Week continues all this week as we explore Iowa, a place to grow. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.